Well, NATO continues its provocation of Russia with new long-range weapons to try to be attacked inside of Russia. That is the move. And we heard Jens Stoltenberg last week giving Zelensky the go-ahead, the green light. You know what? Use these long-range weapons to attack inside Russia. How is that going to go? And you'd have to be a fool to think that Putin is just sort of going to sit back and let that unfold on his watch as you attack his sovereign territory. Earlier today, Putin revealed that the new Sarmat intercontinental nuclear missiles have entered service with the Russian army. And over the past few hours, Russia has mobilized a portion of their nuclear missiles onto the streets. It's always interesting when you see nuclear missiles rolling down the street. Colonel Douglas McGregor posted this on X a few hours ago. Moscow's message: do not escalate and attack Russia. Moscow controls the escalatory ladder, not Washington. We hold a weak hand and are bluffing. In poker, we call it a dead man's hand. Moscow holds a strong hand and it's not bluffing. We thought we'd ask the colonel himself to go in more detail about this. And Colonel McGregor joins us now. Nice to see you, Colonel. Welcome.
Good to see you too, Clay.
Well, you say Russia is not bluffing, and I think a lot of people in the West, it seems like they continue to play this game. Like, how much can we needle him? How much can we surround Russia before it's like a caged bear?
No, I think that's right. And you would think at this point they would have figured out after, what, almost 3 years, it's a big mistake to underestimate the Russians. They're actually quite serious about defending their country, which is what they demonstrated when they went into eastern Ukraine. But I think the important thing to keep in mind with these nuclear missiles is the following. If you try to enter Russian sovereign territory on the ground with any European or American military formations, if you strike us on the ground, anything that is significant, we have the capability to annihilate you. And we will use it, and we will start at the tactical level with tactical nuclear weapons, and we'll work our way up as needed. They're not about to back down and leave Ukraine under any circumstances, and they're certainly not interested in a war. If they were, we'd have been at war with Russia a long time ago. That's obvious. But they're not going to sit there and pretend that they somehow or another are going to be intimidated by us. And we have nothing with which to challenge them. Our ground forces are in ruins. I'm sure you've seen the news with Macron, who stood up and turned himself into the proverbial turd in the punch bowl by suggesting that Europeans should be prepared to march into eastern Ukraine.
Yeah, Napoleon Bonaparte Macron.
Yeah, except Napoleon actually had a real army. You know, Macron has a good thing. There are 72,000 troops in the British army. The French army is a little larger. But these are boutique forces. They're all designed to essentially oppress people that can't defend themselves in North Africa or the Middle East or Africa itself. I mean, they don't have forces that are designed to fight anybody who can fight back.
What do you make of the back and forth then with Macron saying we're not taking this off the table to put ground forces in Ukraine on the part of the French government? Olaf Scholz then having to come out and deliver a video message where he says, under no circumstances, as I, Chancellor of Germany, would put forces into Ukraine. Maybe it is, by the way, I was kind of reading into that. I was really studying his language there because I think you speak German, you understand. The way what he was saying specifically is I, as chancellor, would not put ground forces into Ukraine of Germany. But he doesn't have the power to do that. The Bundestag does. So he wouldn't be the one that would put ground forces in there anyway. Anyway, I found that interesting, this back and forth between he and Macron. What did you make of that?
Well, strictly speaking, Scholz fancies himself a Bismarckian figure. And the German chancellor, certainly before World War I, was an enormously powerful figure. And he had great authority to do almost anything he wanted given to him by the emperor. So I think there's a certain amount of self-delusion involved with that. But he knows the Germans have no interest in this. Nobody in Europe has an interest in going to war in Ukraine. All of this is a proxy effort. What can we do to weaken Russia? You would think by now the fools would recognize that all they've done is strengthen Russia. Russia is stronger militarily now than it's been since the 1980s. Now they're showing you the latest tactical nuclear weapons, mobile nuclear missiles that can essentially hit any target they need to in Europe. They could vaporize airfields, ports, cities as needed. The other thing is we don't have any air defense. In other words, we talk about air and missile defense, but we really don't have much.
In the United States?
Well, both in the United States and in Europe. we've always depended on our air forces. And the underlying assumption has been that our air forces can penetrate anything and drop bombs with impunity and launch missiles with impunity. That's not really true anymore. The Russians are heavily invested in integrated air defenses, integrated air and missile defenses. They're quite prepared to deal with us if we rely exclusively on the Air Force. And to be blunt, that's all we've got right now.
Ooh, terrifying to think about. We talk about Star Wars of the 1980s. We talk about the Iron Dome in Israel, right? But the United States is sort of a sitting duck here. We can't even handle quote-unquote Chinese spy balloons flying over Montana, for crying out loud. We panicked when Balloon Boy was up a number of years ago. Remember that famous story?
Yeah.
So it's unbelievable to me. I think a lot of people sort of sitting back going about their day-to-day business here. But NATO just keeps going, keeps expanding. Jens Stoltenberg last week telling Zelensky, long-range weapons, we're giving you the green light to attack inside of Russia. NATO membership for Sweden. This is moving right up to their back door. I mean, something has to give here. I mean, we're at this like boiling point moment here, and I don't know what do you think is going to give?
NATO is never so weak as when it appears to be strong. The more talk you hear about unity of effort and larger, more powerful NATO capabilities, the less seriously you should take any of these comments. You've got 32 states today constituting the so-called NATO alliance, getting agreement on much of anything, including, you know, which door do we use in the conference room to get to the bathroom is impossible. There's no unity of thinking or effort at all. The whole sham alliance is designed to create avenues of approach for Europeans to us. It's another channel of communication to try and acquire U.S. favor and support and backing. These are all small countries today. They're much like the Greek city-states in the age of the Roman Empire. We're a sort of declining Rome at this point. I hope Americans will figure that out and act against it, but we're a declining Rome. The European states are like the little Greek city-states that were entirely dependent upon Roman military power to save them from the Macedonians. This whole business is a sham. NATO is probably not going to survive. I wouldn't pay any attention to any of it. I think Scholz knows that if he takes a stupid decision, let's send three German brigades, you know, towards Belarusia, something like that, he'll be out of office. Not only will his political structure collapse, will the economy tank, but the whole NATO alliance will go out of business.
I want to ask you to put on your political hat for a moment. Of course, you served Donald Trump at the Pentagon, and you see what's happening now in an election year. You see this back and forth fighting over Ukraine aid. Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, saying, you know, look, I'm not giving up this leverage. That seems to me the only leverage they have right now, Republicans have, which is this Ukraine aid to try to get something done at the U.S. southern border. But at the end of the day, Victoria Nuland says, I see Congress passing this money. There's going to be another $60 billion that'll flow to Ukraine. What do you think is going to happen in Washington? Will this aid get passed, moved towards Ukraine?
On one hand, Victoria Nuland is referring to the structure of power in Washington, which is entirely in the hands of the great lobby and lobbies.
Right.
In other words, not just the Israel lobby, the defense lobby, any number of wealthy billionaire oligarchs that have bought up politicians for years, they are ultimately making policy in Washington, D.C. So she's banking on that working. There's a problem with that assumption. And the problem is that everyone in the United States who is an American citizen, I'm talking about Americans, those of us that don't hyphenate our identity, those of us who don't live here part-time or only when the weather's good or something else, we're Americans. We are not interested in what's happening anywhere in the world, but right now, our own country and the southern border. Everyone is watching millions upon millions of people pile into this country. People that we are not only not vetting, but these are people that are supposed to be rapidly repurposed as future voters for the Uniparty in Washington, D.C. to provide for permanent government. Americans are waking up. They figure that out. They're watching the criminality. We could sit here and talk for hours about all the crimes committed by these recently arrived so-called migrants. They're just illegal aliens that the administration has decided to let in. And they've got lots of backing from wealthy people. you know, you've got people like the Koch brothers that support this sort of thing for reasons that they have that are exclusively of importance to them. There's no one with any real money or power influencing Washington decision-making in favor of the country. In other words, you, I, and millions of us are really not represented. So we're told, stand around, you know, sit down, don't get excited, and let us overrun your country and create a new majority that will govern you and reduce you effectively to a shameless, mindless consumer. You know, be part of the sheeple and shut up. And don't worry about the economy. We'll continue to print money. I mean, look at your GDP figures. Everybody says, oh, this is great. Well, a third to half of that's government money anyway.
Right.
People don't seem to get it. You've talked about the economy. That thing is on its way down into the abyss. But until it strikes, people will stand back and they'll wonder and wait. But at some point, you know, things that fall into the abyss eventually reach bottom. And then all hell is going to break loose. But no one today who is going to vote and wants to vote, who cares about the country, gives a damn what's happening in Eastern Europe, or for that matter, in the Middle East. No one's interested in joining these wars. They don't want us to be dragged into these wars. They want things to be made right here at home. And if I were advising President Trump, and I'm sure he has plenty of people telling those, it doesn't matter what you say about the other things. What is the top issue for American people? Border security, end to illegal immigration, crush the criminality, expel the illegals. That's what Americans want. Talk about that, you're going to get elected. I think he knows that.
You know Trump very well. If he becomes president again, clearly it looks like, you know, he's going to win the Republican nomination unless something crazy happens with Nikki Haley in the deep state wanting to install her in his stead. But if he becomes the Republican nominee and if he goes on to win the election and you were to advise the president, what would you advise him to do on Ukraine?
Well, as far as Ukraine is concerned, I would immediately announce a suspension of all aid to the Ukrainian regime, to Zelensky. Then privately through channels, I would let Moscow know that we're interested in settling this issue as quickly as possible. Let us know when and where you want to meet, and we'll help settle this issue. And I would inform all of our NATO allies of the same thing. So that's the way you handle Ukraine. It's not going to happen overnight. I know he says, well, I can stop this in 24 hours. But even if you told the Russians you were going to do that, they'd wait for 2 weeks to see whether or not you did it.
Right.
There's no reason for them to believe us.
Yeah, well, they know in the Tucker Carlson interview, they've been lied to multiple times. Promises made by Bill Clinton, promises made by George W. Bush, promises made over and over again that have been broken. So they're going to sit back and wait to see if this is a legitimate move or not. It'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to watch what Donald Trump does on these big issues, if he's paying attention.
You know, one thing to remember about President Trump is that every one of his rallies that he attended in 2016, when he was running for election the first time, you had tens of thousands of people chant the same slogan over and over and over again: build the wall, build the wall, build the wall. He was elected, and what did he do? He focused on Obamacare. So my concern is much will depend upon the people who surround him, the people to whom he listens. And I'm not very encouraged by the so-called America First Institute down in Florida and the people that are there, or the usual suspects that go back to the last administration that seemed to populate his inner circle. So I just don't know. So for me to say categorically he will do X, Y, and Z is impossible.
Right.
I just don't.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There's so many people surrounding him. You know, the idea of draining the swamp, you know, that was the goal, right? To drain the swamp. It only got larger under Trump. And a lot of people say, well, it was the people surrounding him that insulated the swamp from being drained, kept him from doing it. Is there truth to that?
Absolutely. And if you look at what's happening right now in the Middle East, all sorts of people are saying they're watching every day as hundreds of human beings are being slaughtered in Gaza. Well, some will say, well, they're Arabs. You know, we've been brainwashed to think that Arabs are unworthy of being treated equally with everybody else. I mean, how could that be avoided when you look at the long-term occupation in Iraq and so forth? But the majority of people are not pleased with it. They don't like it, and they know that we're supporting it. So the question is, how do you stop it? It's very simple. the president of the United States tells Mr. Netanyahu, I am withdrawing all support immediately until such time I see evidence that you are changing what you are doing in Gaza. No, he's not going to do that. Never will do that. So it doesn't make any difference what Sullivan or the rest of these people say, or how many times they bring out the crying cow and express concern for the people in Gaza. They're not going to change anything. So that means that sometime over the next 90 days, the only way to change these things is for a major war to break out in the region. And that means that the Arab states that surround Israel are not really capable of taking on and defeating Israel. This is the big myth of what's the existential threat to Israel. Well, it certainly isn't an Arab threat. That leaves you basically with the Turks and the Iranians. The Iranians are not going to attack anyone unless they themselves are attacked. They've made that very clear. But they're also not going to allow Hezbollah to be destroyed. And that appears to be the next target for Mr. Netanyahu. So that opens up another can of worms. And then you have Mr. Erdogan. He's under tremendous pressure at home to do something. And in many ways, he could have a huge impact. He might succeed in diverting the Israelis from what they're doing without necessarily going to war. But he's the one power in the region with 90 million Turks and the largest armed forces in NATO and very capable fighting forces, not the nonsense we see in Western Europe. We're talking about serious army formations full of Turks who will eagerly kill the enemy. That's what he's got. And that should give the Israelis pause. But thus far, Mr. Erdogan has talked a good game, but he hasn't really heavily engaged. So unless something in the region happens, Mr. Netanyahu will continue to do what he's doing. But he's overreaching. There's no question about it. It's only a matter of time. Those who overreach fail. We've seen that in history many, many times. If he goes into Lebanon, he's overreaching.
Well, if he continues this massive slaughter in Rafah, we'll see what the international community does. We'll see what Egypt does to respond, opens their border, allows these individuals to flow into their open-air prison. And we'll see what the United States does, continues to be basically silent about it and play the game. Well, we've been telling them to go easy on these Palestinians. We've been telling them not to shoot civilians. We've been telling them. We've used strong words. Yeah. We've been using strong words. But that's about all they're doing. Colonel McGregor, great to see you as always. Thank you so much for your insights, your time. We appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Clayton. Bye-bye.
I really hope you enjoyed watching this video. You know, YouTube thinks that you'll actually like this next video right here. It's personalized based on your own viewing habits. So if you watch the video, please leave a comment. Let us know what you think about it. And we will see you next time, everyone.